What's the upside of staying single? Kate Bullock, author of Spinster, will be here to talk about making a life of one's own.
I like to think of the word spinster as a way to hold on to that in you, which is autonomous and individual and self-reliant, no matter your actual relationship status.
Is large-scale public shaming back and worse than ever? John Ronson will join us to talk about his new book, So You've Been Publicly Shamed.
We're not thinking it through. We're not being judicious. We're not being democratic. We scream out any dissent. And it's us. You know, it's nice people like us.
Alexandra Alter will share her notes from the publishing world. And Greg Coles has bestseller news. This is Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Pamela Paul. Kate Bullock is here to talk about her new book, Spinster, Making a Life of One's Own. Hi, Kate.
Hi.
So this book started off as a story for The Atlantic, a cover story for like the few people who didn't see that story. Tell us about what that was.
So that story was called All the Single Ladies, and it started as an assignment from The Atlantic. They asked me to look into how the economy and men's worsening economic prospects were changing the future of dating, marriage, and the family. So that's the article I had been assigned. And once I started researching it, I came across the demographics around us having more single people than ever before and realized that that's what this story was about, that marriage rates weren't changing just because men were having a worse time during the recession. So I ended up writing a lot about this new growing single person demographic.
So the idea that they started off with was, you know, do women not need men anymore now that they can make money on their own and men's economic prospects are sort of disintegrating or at least getting worse because of the recession? Was that the sort of general?
You know, their angle wasn't so much that women didn't need men. Their angle was what's going to happen to women now that men aren't as marriageable as they once were. So that's they were coming from a very male-centric place. And I turned it around a little bit and said, well, actually, women don't need marriage the way that they once did.
And Exhibit A was kind of yourself.
Right.
So what was your story up to that point?
At the time, I was 38, turning 39, and I had never been married. And so they had asked me to write that story in the first person, drawing on my own experiences, so that my own life became part of that article.
Did you think of the story as being primarily about yourself, or were you thinking about it as being this sort of larger?
I thought of the story as being completely about a larger demographic and sociological trends that we're going through. And I was using myself as a tool, as a literary device,
right,
to draw a reader through the story.
I mean, this so often happens in the media that a lot of the attention then was really directed at you and
right,
at your personal story. So going into turning this into a book, sort of how did you bring that experience into the way you approach the book?
Experiencing so much media exposure was sort of traumatizing, and it made me have a bit of an identity crisis. You know, like once I had this new book deal in hand and knew that I was going to be writing about the topic, I knew how I wanted to write about it, but I felt the pressure of how I imagined other people expected me to write about it, which I didn't want to do. But it took a while to be able to really push that expectation away far enough that I could get my own voice back onto the page. And I also wanted very much to create a more intimate reading experience than the article had. I wanted to take advantage of what a book allows as far as intimacy between the reader and the page. So to take that to an actual real level rather than just using myself strictly as a device.
What you do in the book actually is quite different from what one might expect from the article, in that you don't focus primarily on yourself, but instead talk about five other women, literary women. Who are the women that you focus the book on?
So I write about in the book Neith Boyce, who was a journalist in the late 1800s. And I first came across her through a column she wrote for Vogue in the year 1898 called The Bachelor Girl, about her decision to never marry. She was also a novelist. The poet Edna St. Vincent Millay, the novelist Edith Wharton, the feminist writer and activist Charlotte Perkins Gilman, and the essayist and fiction writer Maeve Brennan are the five women I write about. And I wrote about them because they had been engaging my imagination for years, more than a decade. And in a way, I think of the book as a prelude to the article, that these were the women who had shaped my own thinking about marriage versus not marriage. And when I was writing the Atlantic article, I felt that they were almost physically perched on my shoulder, taking in all of the reporting and researching that I was doing, and I was kind of talking it over with them as I wrote. And I sort of dropped mention of them in the article because I felt that I owed it to them. But the book was my way of really exploring my relationships to them.
The book is called Spinster. Obviously, that's a loaded word, but what do you mean by spinster?
Well, definitely the classic spinster is a never married, unmarried woman and who lives alone. The word originated as an occupational descriptor, like baker or fishmonger in the Middle Ages. It was the only way for young women to work outside of the home was to spin wool into thread. So those were spinners, spinsters, and because the only women who could work were women who didn't have children that they needed to take care of, they were always young, unmarried women. So it became a crossover term. Just a young, unmarried woman was a spinster. It didn't take on a pejorative cast until colonial America, when we were trying to build a nation and needed every woman to be procreating, so because we needed a population to grow. So any woman who was not married and having children was considered an actual menace to society. So if by 23 you weren't married, you were a spinster, and that was a very negative thing. And if by 26 you were still unmarried, you were a thornback, which is a species of flat, spiny fish, which has not stuck around as a word.
Maybe we could bring that back as well, or not. So are these five women in the book that you write about, are they spinsters?
Only two of them ever met the classic definition of a spinster. The rest of them married at some point and had either an open marriage or divorced. So I'm using spinster as a way to talk about the ideas in the book, that we still have archaic ideas of thinking about single women and who she is. We have archaic ideas still about the single woman and who she is. And I like how the term spinster broadcasts that complicated negativity and also the history.
You start off the book with a very provocative sentence. I'm just going to read from it. Whom to marry and when will it happen? These two questions define every woman's existence, regardless of where she was raised or what religion she does or doesn't practice. That's a sentence, you know, that could come straight out of Jane Austen. It goes back centuries. It's provocative that would still hold true today.
Right. And the key word in that sentence is questions, that these questions are what shape us, that we grow up wondering how we're going to answer these questions, even if we choose not to marry. And that sentence came to me in a strangely supernatural feeling way. I was walking through my apartment and it was like a voice just came from somewhere else and spoke those lines. And I thought, that's so strange. It doesn't sound like my voice. And I wrote it down. I think it's because that voice is the voice of culture and expectation. It is a disembodied invisibility.
Do you see it changing in that a young girl might know from the very beginning, no, I don't want to marry?
I don't think young girls quite yet know from the beginning. I think Frozen and Brave have been really useful in providing alternate narratives to the Disney princess story. But, you know, even my niece, every time I see her, she's now 7. She says, when are you getting married? When are you having babies? It's still, marriage is still how we organize our society. So although this demographic, this huge influx of unmarried people is still so new to us that it's still taking a little while for that reality to trickle into the consciousnesses of our young people.
So how do you think about marriage at this point in your life? I'm assuming you're still not married.
Correct. I'm still not married. And I've always thought maybe someday I'll get married. I've never been against marriage or actively disinterested in it. So this book is not an argument against marriage. I think there are interesting arguments to be made around it, but they don't interest me very much. And I think that they've been made very well before. My own relationship to marriage is just much more one of ambivalence. And so it was something I always assumed I would do and just kept not doing. And so now who knows?
So is this book about questioning that assumption and thinking about alternatives to that assumption?
Yes. And I think it's also about how do we carve out our own life path according to our own internal needs and desires rather than in response to what we think we're supposed to be doing.
Our reviewer, Heather Haverleski, in her review noted that the book is largely about the pleasures of solitude, which seems like a kind of lost art in general in our contemporary society. But is it especially so for women?
I do think it's probably harder for women to achieve if they're working full time and married and raising children, that solitude is at a premium. My own relationship to solitude has changed. So when I've always liked solitude, I'm somewhat introverted. I've always needed to be alone and reflective in order to, you know, recharge, et cetera. Up until the age of 30, I was in long-term relationships with other people, and solitude always felt like a stolen good, something that I had to snatch and savor on my own. And I didn't want that to be my whole life. I wanted solitude to be a central component of my life. And for me, the way that I found, the way I made sense of that was, well, I have to get myself out of relationships for various reasons. But one is to protect solitude and have it be expansive rather than stolen and limited.
And is that part of what you see as being a modern spinster?
Yes, definitely. And I like to think of the word spinster as a way to hold on to that in you, which is autonomous and individual and self-reliant, no matter your actual relationship status. And it's important, I think, for all of us to remember that none of us are defined by our relationship status. It may seem so, but our statuses change. So we can be single at any point in our lives.
This is not a self-help book, so I don't mean to suggest that it is, but the subtitle is Making a Life of One's Own. How do you see the five women in this book as sort of what can a reader take away from their lives and in a contemporary context that would help them make a life?
The women I write about are endlessly interesting to me. And among other things, I'm interested in how their relationships to the ideas of relationships feel timeless to me, even though they were living under different social historic circumstances than we are today. Even so, the ideas around the tension between autonomy and independence and intimacy are very personal, individual, felt emotional experiences. So the ways in which they talk about them feel outside of time. And they kept me company through my own ambivalence around these ideas and how to sort through them. And to listen to them and watch them and how they negotiated their own ambivalence and stayed true to what they wanted and felt was right for themselves was just a very helpful conversation for me to be having, even though it was inside my own head.
I want to end with where you started, which was that 1898 Vogue article by Neith Boyce, The Bachelor Girl. Give us a quote from that or an idea from that, that from 1898 about the bachelor girl life that sort of still holds today.
So in the year 1898, the journalist and novelist Neith Boyce wrote a column for Vogue called The Bachelor Girl about her decision to never marry. And I read it on microfiche machine, you know, in that little tiny text, the ways in which magazines and newspapers used to be printed. And the first line of her column is, I was born a bachelor, but of course several years elapsed before my predestination to this career became obvious. And she goes on over the course of 7 or 8 months to just write about her own experiences as a happily unmarried woman. And in a way, I think of this, the excerpts from this column are the most self-helpy part of the book because she's giving advice to readers, and it's advice that still holds true today. So it's be confident, wear clean clothes.
All good things.
you know, keep in mind that, you know, the bachelor girl is self-sufficient. She's working to make a living. It feels most comfortable around women who are most like her. So that's why you see bachelor girls alone together a lot of the time. She talks about what she calls the, you know, the prevalent matrimonial epidemic, and that how easy it is to catch the engagement germ, and that there's always somebody to marry if your standards aren't very high. So she's very funny and clear and frank and unapologetic, and in pre-identity politics is part of what drew me to that period, is how people like Neith were talking about their own lives in a personal way that felt fresh and uncorrupted by history, basically.
And very positive.
Yes. Yeah.
All right. The book again is Spinster, Making a Life of One's Own by Kate Bullock. Kate, thanks so much.
Thanks so much, Pamela.
Alexandra Alter is here with Notes from the Publishing World. Hi, Alexandra.
Hi, Pamela.
So neither of us is in London right now, but let's talk about London.
London, yes. This is where everyone that I'm trying to reach this week for interviews is currently. All the major publishers are at the London Book Fair, and a number of big deals closed right before the start of the fair as publishers are scrambling to get rights to things. We're seeing, again, some debut novelists raking in seven-figure deals. This trend is continuing. So
right.
A couple of the books that people are talking about, one was bought by Knopf, and it's a debut novel by a 25-year-old writer named Yag Yassi. She got seven figures for it, apparently, and 10 publishers were bidding. And it's about two half-sisters in 18th-century Ghana who were born in different villages and didn't know each other, and their lives, you know, diverged wildly, and then they meet up again. Another book that a lot of people are talking about is The Waters and the Wild, and this is a debut novel by an Oberlin College poetry professor, DeSales Harrison.
They always get the big deals.
The poetry professors are rolling in cash. It's like poetry professor turned James Patterson here. Kate Medina at Penguin Random House bought the book for seven figures. It was Bill Clegg who represented the author, and he's famous for getting massive advances.
He also has a big novel
of
his
own. And he has his own big novel coming out in the fall, which he sold to a new Simon & Schuster imprint. The title is Did You Ever Have a Family? It's quite tragic, and it sold for a rumored seven figures as well.
All right, so this new one is by DeSales
Harrison, and it's called The Waters in the Wild, and there's no publication date yet, but it sounds sort of thriller-esque. It starts with the death of a young woman who was a former heroin addict and had a history of depression. Everyone thinks she overdosed, but her psychoanalyst sees that it sort of starts to unravel the mystery and suspects foul play.
When we hear about these big sales going on now, when do we actually see the books generally? How long does it take from this kind of announcement to, you know, a bookstore near you?
That's a great question. I think with fiction, it's usually a year out often because they tend to buy completed novels or at least, a good portion of a manuscript. When you have these big nonfiction deals, it's often in advance that allows the author to go do some research. And so that could be, you know, we could be thinking of 2 to 5 years or longer for a nonfiction deal. On the nonfiction front, a book that's getting a lot of attention at London is Mo Gaudet's Solve for Happy. This is someone who works at Google X, which is the part of Google that is working on self-driving cars and Google Glass and all kinds of futuristic products. And this is a book on a subject that is of interest to everyone because it's how to maximize happiness. And he's apparently applying technology and statistics and all of his Google brain power to this problem. And it apparently sold in a six-figure deal to Scribner.
In the future, we will all be happy.
And then, of course, you know, the biggest news at London is still Harper Lee's Go Set a Watchman. Her agent has signed up 25 foreign publishers at this point, and he's doing it in a somewhat unusual way just because of the, you know, extremely sensitive nature of this book. He's having publishers come to his office and read the book under tight security. He's not sending out samples or manuscripts for anyone to read on their own.
Is To Kill a Mockingbird an international success as much as it is an American success?
As far as I can tell, it is, because I think the global sales are, you know, substantial. It's sold more than 40 million copies globally. Even though it's a, you know, quintessentially American story, I think it resonates overseas just with the, you know, the father-daughter relationship and
right.
all that kind of stuff.
And there are certain very American stories, John Steinbeck, that tend to really do well internationally.
That's right. And there was another little mini trend that emerged at London, which is a little bit disturbing. There were two big sales for books about serial killers. One centered on the widow of a serial killer. Another was about the daughter of a serial killer. So we'll see if there's going to be a third book on serial killers.
All right. Let's do our London Book Fair segment live from London next year.
I'd love that.
All right. Thanks, Alexandra.
Bye.
John Ronson joins us now. His new book is So You've Been Publicly Shamed. Hi, John.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm good. Well, I'm not good because I'm sitting here reading the beginning of this book about this incident you had, and I'm like incredibly angry on your behalf. But maybe it had a good resolution. Tell us about what happened when three academics decided to set up a Twitter feed in your name.
Yeah, I just noticed one day I was on Twitter and there was this other John Ronson on Twitter with my face. So his avatar was my face and my name. And as I looked in surprise at its timeline, it tweeted, "Going home, got to get the recipe for a huge plate of mussel and guarana in a bap with mayonnaise, hashtag yummy."
A tidy plate of onion grill.
Yeah, a tidy plate of onion grill. So I was like, who are you? And then it tweeted, "I'm dreaming something about time and cock." So I was baffled and mystified. And also, I noticed that it was being followed by people that I knew from real life who were obviously wondering, you know, why I'd suddenly become so interested in fusion cooking, which is not one of my concerns in life. So, yeah, it turned out to be a spam bot, like a fake me Twitter account created by these academics.
Right, because spam bot implies that it's some kind of machine, but there were real people behind this endeavor.
Yes, exactly. And they wouldn't call it a spam bot. They called it an infomorph. There was some sort of exercise, some kind of academic exercise, which I still don't quite understand like why they'd chosen me and what it was all about.
When the paper comes out, you'll understand.
I guess. What I did find out, though, was that they were refusing to take down the spam bot, even though, you know, there were people out there who were convinced it was me, and people who enjoyed my books were following it, thinking I was a kind of, you know, I must be in real life an idiot. Because all I would do is sort of, you know, tweet about these fabulous dinner parties I was having. Whereas in that entire period, I wasn't invited to any dinner parties. So the spam bot was having a much better life than I was having. I finally said to these guys, look, if you won't take the spam bot down, can I at least meet you and film you and you can explain the rationale behind the spam bot? And they said, yes, they'd be delighted to meet me and explain the rationale behind the infomorph. And I said, that's great, because I'm very much looking forward to hearing the rationale behind the spam bot. So we were having a kind of passive-aggressive conversation about that. So finally, yeah, I met them, and they were these three intellectuals, and they told me that they were annoyed with me, because what right did I have to be the only John Ronson?
This is an incredibly Kafka-esque confrontation that you have here.
It really was. They said another reason why I had no right to be annoyed was that the internet is not the real world. And I found that so interesting because, you know, this is what my book's about, really, that we are destroying people on the internet. And one of the ways we justify that behavior to ourselves, because we don't like to see ourselves as bad people, is we think, oh, well, the internet's not the real world. And in the real world, I'm sure they're fine. They can just turn off the internet and everything will be fine. But it's not true. When we destroy people on the internet, we're destroying them in the real world.
Well, it's interesting. I was talking to a television personality last night, and she was talking about how incredibly mean people were online to her. And she said, it's as if they don't think that I'm reading it. You know, it's as if they don't actually believe that there is a connection between what occurs online and the real world. I mean, do you think that part of the problem is that do people think that there's a fundamental disconnect, or is that just an excuse?
Well, I think there's cognitive dissonance going on, right? We like to see ourselves as good people, yet we are destroying people And so we need to come up with you know, justifications for it. And one justification is to use demonizing language against the person we've just destroyed. Say, oh, they're a sociopath, or they're incapable of feeling shame. Some of the people I followed in this book were being destroyed, you know, for a joke that lands badly. I mean, that's what we're talking about when we talk about the level of their transgression. And the people, you know, would write about them. They are incapable of feeling shame.
You know, the concept of shame, the questionable, quote-unquote, virtue of shame, is something that politically on the right, the decline of the concept of shame has been lamented among social conservatives, that we need to bring back shame, that people have become too shameless. Do you write about this?
Yes, and it's so interesting. When I was telling people that I was writing a book about shame and public shaming, I would tell these sort of, you know, elderly architects, I'm writing this book about shame, and they'd say that, and say, oh, thank God, you know, there's so much shamelessness in society these days. It's good that you're writing about bringing back shame. And, you know, they had no idea that I was writing the opposite. My book is about how there's way too much shaming in the world, that people are just going, you know, shaming crazy, just piling shame onto shame. The reason why I think people on the right feel that way is because they're thinking about old-fashioned shamings. So, you know, they see women wearing provocative clothes, as they would see it, and they say, look at that shameless woman. There's too much shamelessness going on, and, you know, people are just too sexually loose and so on. But the fact is that there's more shaming than ever going on, and there's more shame than ever going on. It's just moved elsewhere. It's moved to a different place. Nobody cares about consensual sex scandals anymore, especially right. If you're a man. But what people care hugely about now is the misuse of privilege. That's a destroyable offense now. And of course, it's better to be concerned about the misuse of privilege than it is about consensual sex scandals. But the problem is, we're so in love with destroying people who are misusing their privilege that we've massively let our standards slip, and we're destroying whoever we like and then justifying it by saying they were misusing their privilege.
So we've gone from the scarlet letter sort of standard of shame to this newer concept of abusing.
Yeah, that's kind of the default now. Like, whatever it is that somebody's done, you know, whatever transgression, huge numbers of people, nice, empathetic, liberal people like me, justify it by saying, well, they were misusing their privilege.
Right. One thing that seems to happen online with public shaming is an almost gleeful piling on, almost as if it has become shameful not to register your disapproval of someone, the object of this shaming's misconduct.
Yes, absolutely. You know, one of the terrible ironies here is that everybody wants to show everybody else how empathetic they are. We want to show people that, you know, we are fighting the good fight, we are working towards social justice. So it's in this kind of frantic desire to be empathetic that's what's leading us to commit these profoundly unempathetic acts. Tens of thousands of people, hundreds of thousands of people are piling in on somebody who really doesn't deserve it. I'm talking about the tiniest transgressions. I'm not talking about serious transgressions. And the reason why it's happening is because of this mandatory desire to show everybody how empathetic we are.
Right. It's like not showing up to the public hanging.
Yes. And in fact, if anybody gets in the way, if anybody says, I'm not sure that that person deserves it, that person is then in danger. Because, you know, because of the way that social media is designed as a kind of mutual approval machine, we surround ourselves with people who feel the same way we do. You know, it's a wonderful feeling to be approved by strangers. But the problem is then, you know, we're kind of drunk with being approved while we're tearing somebody apart. The flame burns hot. And when somebody gets in the way and says, I think what you're doing is inappropriate, we ferociously turn on them and we tear that person apart. And what that is fermenting is a climate of utter fear. You know, the bullies have taken over the school. So when we shame somebody, they get fired from their jobs because their employers are like, oh, my God, you know, if we don't get rid of this person, we might be next. Nobody interferes. Nobody kind of intervenes on the shamee's behalf,
right,
because they could be next. And I see, and if any of this sounds kind of like I'm, you know, overselling this, I'm really not. I mean, anybody who's been in the midst of a shaming where everybody agrees that that person has done a terrible, terrible thing, it's profoundly undemocratic and it's frightening.
Let's bring this down to the horrible particularities of an individual case. Tell us a story of one of these public shamings.
Okay, will I tell you the story of Justine Sacco?
Yes.
I particularly like this story because some people have said to me and have written that, you know, I was right to write a book about how public shaming is out of control, you know, these days, in the last year or two, but I was wrong to make Justine Sacco a figure in my book because she deserved it.
Oh, God.
And so this is Justine's story. She's a New York City PR woman, 170 Twitter followers, and she's traveling to Cape Town, and she tweets, she's at Heathrow Airport about to get on the plane, and she tweets, "Going to Africa, hope I don't get AIDS, just kidding, I'm white." And then presses send and gets no replies. When my book was extracted in the New York Times, the fact checker phoned her up and said, "So were you surprised that you got no replies?" And she said, "I have 170 Twitter followers. Nobody ever replied to my jokes."
Right.
So she got on the plane, fell asleep, woke up 10 hours later in Cape Town, turned on her phone, and straight away there's a message from somebody she hasn't spoken to since high school that said, "I am so sorry to see what's happening to you." And she just looked at it baffled, you know, what on earth did this woman mean? And then another text from her best friend, "You need to phone me right away. You are the worldwide number one trending topic on Twitter." So, you know, while she slept, that joke, which was intended to be a kind of, you know, a joke in the tradition of a Randy Newman song,
right,
or an episode of South Park, went around the world, stripped of its nuance, stripped of its context, destroyed her. And in fact, much of the hilarity was the fact that while the people worked out that she was oblivious to her destruction, she was on a plane, asleep, oblivious to her destruction. And that was the joy of it. We are about to watch this Justine Sacco bitch get fired in real time before she even knows she's being fired.
It used to be that the object of a public shaming either was a public figure, a celebrity, or someone in public office. Or back in the day when everybody lived and worked in a tiny little village and everybody knew each other, you know, a local person who everyone actually knew. But this seems like an odd middle ground where anyone is susceptible. Anyone can become the target.
Anyone. And part of the problem, and in fact, I think an enormous part of the problem, is that, okay, the power is in our hands. And when I say us, I mean, I guess, you know, social justice people who want to fight the appropriate fight. The power is in our hands. But we are not discerning. We can't tell the difference. You know, the level of Justine Sacco's punishment was akin to the punishment of the NYPD as they had a man in a chokehold. It's like we were as furious with Justine Sacco for a liberal joke that landed badly as we are with the NYPD who aren't indicted for putting a man in a chokehold. So we have the power and we are wielding it like toddlers crawling towards a gun. We're not thinking it through. We're not being judicious.
Right.
We're not being democratic. We scream out any dissent. And it's us. You know, it's nice people like us. And I've noticed, you know, I mean, just with this, the book's been out a week or two, the sort of waves of shaming I've had as a result of this book have been like, you know, the sort of waves of nausea you get when you've got a stomach bug. You know, people are desperately trying to find ways to not have to think about my book by saying, well, you know, John Ronson supported Justine Sacco, he must be a racist too.
So you're being publicly shamed.
Being publicly shamed for writing a book advocating more empathy and less cold, hard judgment.
How horrifically inappropriately appropriate.
I know, right? I wish, like when I'm in the middle of it, I wish I could rightfully think to myself, oh, the irony. In fact, when I'm in the middle of it, I'm thinking, oh, God, and I'm waking up at 4 o'clock in the morning and frantically checking Twitter, just like everybody else, okay, you know, who's being attacked on Twitter.
Well, your next...
the anxiety snakes its way into your head.
Your next book can be about redemption.
Right. Well, I sort of think this book's about redemption. It's about there's nothing more frightening than being cast out into the wilderness by, you know, told you were worthless. And there's nothing better and more healing than being brought back in. And this book is a book about, you know, how we need to remember that human beings are dimensional. We are a mixture of brilliant and stupid. And the cure is compassion, empathy, and kindness.
I want to end on that very positive note, given the sort of horrible nature of the topic. So, John, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. That was a pleasure.
The book again is So You've Been Publicly Shamed. People Will Only Tweet Nice Things About This Conversation, by John Ronson. Greg Coles has Bestseller News. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Pamela.
There's a lot new this week.
There is a lot new on both the fiction and the nonfiction hardcover lists. Let's start with fiction, where down at number 15, the British writer Philip Kerr continues his Bernie Gunther detective series with a book called The Lady from Zagreb. Kerr is British. In fact, in 1993, he was one of Granta's best young British novelists. But these thrillers are actually about a German homicide detective during the Nazi era. And they have gotten a lot of attention. But the only time that he's hit the list before was with the previous novel in the series, A Man Without Breath, which hit in 2013.
All right. Well, going in the right direction then for
yeah.
him.
Then new at number 14, Karen Kingsbury has the second book in her Angels Walking series. It's called Chasing Sunsets. It's her first appearance on the bestseller list. Then at number 12, Lisa Genova, who of course wrote Still Alice, which became the basis for the movie, has a book called Inside the O'Briens. Still Alice, you probably remember, was about early onset Alzheimer's. Lisa Genova has specialized a little bit in this kind of disease of the week type narrative. Inside the O'Briens is about a police officer who finds out that he has Huntington's disease when he's in his mid-40s. Then new at number 10, James Patterson teams up with his old collaborator, Peter DeJonge. Let's call it DeJonge, DeJonge, for a book called Miracle at Augusta, a golf narrative. Then at number 9, Joe Nesbo has a book called Blood on Snow, not part of his Harry Hole series, but his second consecutive standalone thriller. It's called Blood on Snow, new at number 9. At number 5, Donna Leone continues her Guida Brunetti series of mysteries set in Venice with a book called Falling in Love. This is the 24th book in that series, but only the fourth one to hit the list. And then finally, new at number 4, Stuart Woods continues his Stone Barrington thriller series. This is the 33rd book in the series. It's called Hot Pursuit. And the 32nd consecutive to hit the list.
Wow.
He's hit one list or another with 32 of the 33. The only one that has missed is the first book, New York Dead. It did hit the ebook list, but only on the extended list last year when it was kind of re-released in ebook format.
And what's with nonfiction?
Nonfiction. There are 5 new titles. Starting down at number 15, the composer, the contemporary composer Philip Glass, has a memoir out called Words Without Music that hits the list at number 15.
He wrote a previous book about music, but this is more of a memoir.
Yeah, exactly right. This is just looking back at his life, his family, his teachers. He of course does talk about music in it, but it's not a book about music. It's a book about his life.
And a curious book at number 7.
A curious book called A Curious Mind by the Hollywood and TV producer Brian Grazer with co-writer Charles Fishman. It's partly a memoir and partly sort of an inspirational business book about the power of imagination, especially the power of curiosity, how you can use your natural curiosity to explore new things and become a success that way. Then at number five, another memoir, another Hollywood memoir, Candace Bergen, who of course played Murphy Brown. She had a previous memoir 30 years ago called Knock Wood, about growing up with the father. She's the daughter of the ventriloquist Edgar Bergen, who famous for Charlie McCarthy, the ventriloquist dummy. She grew up as Charlie McCarthy's sister, so to speak. This new book, it's called A Fine Romance, is about her marriage to the director Louis Malle, and her second marriage to Marshall Rose. It's also about her success on Murphy Brown and about her daughter, Chloe Malle.
But all anybody's talking about is about how she admits that she's fat.
That is true. That's gotten a lot of attention. She says that she doesn't want to be one of those women who only eats kale and fish and then goes and throws it all up.
Right. Well, we won't talk about that. Okay. Number three.
Number three, Kate Anderson Brower, former Bloomberg News reporter, White House correspondent, has a book called The Residence, which is about the White House. It sort of inspired by Downton Abbey. It's really a look back at the staff of the White House who stays put as first families come and go. And so it looks, she's interviewed staff going back, I think, 50 years and talks to them about what life is like behind the scenes in the White House.
Lee Daniels, the butler, yeah, the book version.
Think of it as the butler, exactly.
And a brand new name at number one.
At number one, Bill O'Reilly's Legends and Lies by Bill O'Reilly and David Fisher. I was a little bit disappointed to find out that this book was not a collection of his war reporting, but in fact is a tie-in to the Fox News series Legends and Lies, which is a look at back at the Wild West, some of the key figures from that, and attempting to sort out what was real and what was not.
Who were the good guys and who were the bad guys?
Exactly.
All right. Thanks, Greg.
Thanks, Pamela.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. Thanks for listening. For the New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.